A human rights report condemns migrant detention in South Florida. DeSantis Doge threatens Broward County. And WLRN celebrates our city's centennials. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll examine a scathing new study that calls conditions in South Florida's migrant detention centers dehumanizing and getting worse as the Trump administration keeps filling them up. We'll also speak with the mayor of Broward County, whose budget is being targeted by Governor DeSantis's state version of DOGE, and our WLRN reporters will mark the 100th anniversaries of South Florida's cities and their rich stories, from Pearl City to Al Capone. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. In recent weeks, we've been gripped by the sudden appearance of a migrant detention center out in the Everglades dubbed Alligator Alcatraz, where this week, the first 100 or so detainees were flown out on deportation flights. But amid the uproar over its allegedly inhumane conditions, it's easy to forget other South Florida migrant detention facilities continue to generate complaints, from extreme overcrowding to lack of medical care and abusive treatment. And as President Trump's deportation crusade keeps filling those lockups, their situations seem to get worse. That's the conclusion of a report out this week by the international watchdog Human Rights Watch, in partnership with the nonprofits Americans for Immigrant Justice and Sanctuary of the South. It's titled, "You Feel Like Your Life is Over: Abusive Practices at Three Florida Immigration Detention Centers Since January 2025. Those three centers are Chrome North and Federal Detention in Miami and Broward Transitional in Pompano Beach. The report calls conditions at those facilities dehumanizing. Joining me now from Brussels, actually, to discuss the report she co-wrote is Belkis Vile. She is Associate Director in the Crisis, Conflict, and Arms Division for Human Rights Watch. Belkis, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for raising this report on your show.
We'd, of course, like to hear from you, our listeners. Do you know anyone who's being held in one of South Florida's migrant detention centers? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Belkis, can you tell us first why these three migrant detention centers, Chrome, Federal, and Broward, are all under the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, known as ICE? Why did Human Rights Watch and the other groups that assembled this report focus on those South Florida facilities? What made looking at them so critical?
So we've seen a surge in the detention of immigrants across the United States since this current administration has taken office on January 20th. But I would say that the surge we saw in Florida was far more significant. And that is for several reasons, but perhaps the most important amongst them is that it is the state of Florida and its many law enforcement bodies that have signed the vast majority of what are known as 287G agreements with ICE. These are agreements by which ICE then deputizes its authority to detain immigrants in the context of, you know, aimed deportations. And in Florida, we've seen more law enforcement agencies than in any other state signing these. Mm-hmm. In fact, you have at least 15 educational facilities, 12 of them universities, where the campus police have signed these agreements. And that is what has led to such an increase in numbers of people being detained. Yeah. And these three facilities, until the new facility you mentioned in the Everglades was opened, were the largest to be housing immigrants this spring.
Right. And just for some perspective here, I want to just step back one second. I should mention to those who might want to assign a liberal or leftist agenda to Human Rights Watch that you're as critical of left-wing governments like Cuba and Venezuela as you are of conservative governments like the Trump administration, no?
Absolutely. And more than that, we've been working on concerning conditions in immigration detention facilities throughout all administrations, right? For us, the issue is international human rights law. That is what we abide by, and those are the standards we look at. Mm-hmm. But it's also ICE's own standards. The kind of conditions we are talking about in these facilities are violations of ICE's own standards.
Right, and we're gonna get to that. But There were a few common factors at these facilities that the report seemed to zero in on most: extreme overcrowding, unhealthy conditions, and abusive treatment. Now, since so much of the controversy here has to do with the spike in the number of migrant detainees we're seeing in these federal detention centers since President Trump took office again in January, I want to start with the overcrowding issue. What stands out most disturbingly to Human Rights Watch in that regard? And let's just start with the raw numbers, if we can.
Sure. So the numbers at these facilities we looked at have increased. The most notable increase is at the Chrome facility, where what you're talking about is a facility that until January 20th was at capacity in terms of how many immigrants it was holding.
Right.
Within the first 3 months of the year, it ended up at three times its capacity.
Right.
So I was interviewing men who are in cells that are built to house 66 individuals that are now housing 120, 140 men with mattresses strewn all over the grounds. We heard about people arriving at Chrome in February, in March, as these detentions increased. They got there on buses, but the facility was so full they couldn't even be taken off the bus to be processed at the cell. So they spent up to 4 days shackled in a hot bus in the parking lot of Chrome before they could even be checked into the facility.
Right.
And then they were held in these processing cells. You're meant to only be there for a few hours. They were there in some cases for up to 20 days, you know, with no bedding, no access to a shower, in horrifying conditions.
And the report alleges that overcrowding has resulted in rather humiliating instances, such as females being forced to use toilets in full view of male detainees. What other breakdowns in decency, let's say, does the report say this creates?
Well, absolutely. I think one really concerning thing we saw was that suddenly so many women were being detained that I guess, you know, ICE authorities had nowhere else to put them, so they brought them to Chrome. Now, Chrome is a male-only facility. And sort of in an Orwellian twist, these women were brought to Chrome. They were put in a room where the windows were only partially glazed so that, you know, neighboring male detainees in other rooms could stand on a chair and watch them as they were urinating. But then also these women said that when they asked for medical care, and in the case of one cell, there were two women who had very serious medical conditions. They had had their medication in their bag when they were detained.
Right.
They were denied any access to medical care because the staff at the facility said to them, this is a male-only facility, so we are not allowed to even give you a medical checkup.
Right. Now that brings us to the report's second big concern, as we mentioned, which is unhealthy and unsanitary conditions at the Chrome Federal and Broward Migrant Detention Centers. And that appears to include access to medical care, as you just mentioned. You, in fact, highlighted the death in the report of a Haitian woman at the Broward Transitional Detention Center back in April as an example of what the report alleges is relatively inattentive medical and health care there. Again, what stands out most in your mind?
So, you know, there was this chronic denial across all three facilities of access not only to medical staff, you know, including for checkups and if someone becomes ill, but also to getting access to regular medication that has been prescribed by a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So people with diabetes, people with HIV, people with asthma, being stripped of their ability to access their medication by the prison authorities for no particular reason. And that has had critical consequences. So we actually have two deaths that occurred in Chrome and in the Broward Transitional Center, both of which, you know, we know from the family members, we know from the cellmates that there was medical neglect. These individuals were getting sicker and sicker. They were asking to see doctors. They weren't getting adequate treatment, and that is what may have killed them. And one of them you mentioned, this 44-year-old Haitian woman. And I interviewed a woman in the cell opposite her who watched the woman as she was collapsing on the ground, and everyone in that mm-hmm. cell was screaming for officers to come and help. And, you know, the reaction time and the way in which the officers reacted, it could have been what killed her.
Now, a third big concern is alleged abusive treatment by guards and other personnel at the Chrome Federal and Broward Migrant Detention Centers. One example in the report cites detainees being forced, for example, to eat meals with their hands cuffed behind their backs. But does the report see an actual pattern of that sort of abusive treatment in the same way it sees, for example, chronic overcrowding and unsanitary conditions?
There were some emblematic incidents of really degrading treatment that occurred. You mentioned one of those incidents. But I would say that concerns around treatment by guards of these detainees is something that was raised to me by everybody I interviewed across all three facilities. I did hear particular concerns from people who were put at some point during their detention at the federal detention center. And their impression was that the guards at that facility, because the guards there are guards who until now have only been engaging with convicted felons.
Right.
And now, because of the overcrowding, suddenly this facility has been rendered also into an ICE detention facility. And there, the people who I spoke to had been through all three facilities felt that the treatment by guards was even worse. And that's where we saw guards, taunting detainees by putting inappropriate music blasting on the loudspeakers, as you said, forcing men to eat with their mouths off of a chair with their hands tied behind their backs like dogs. And also an incident where they locked up a group of men, didn't feed them, and led to one coughing up blood, and then they locked him into a cell overnight that was covered in blood on the sheets and on the toilet.
Now, an additional but no less serious concern when we talk about abusive treatment is the lack of access to legal counsel and due process that the report says migrant detainees face in these three facilities. How bad is that problem, Belkis? And for that matter, why is it such a problem?
Well, one immediate concern is the processing period. So when people arrive in ICE custody, they go through an intake process that should be short, a matter of hours. And then once they're in their cells, they should be able to have that immediate access to contact with their families and with their lawyers. But what we've seen is that because of the overcrowding, that processing period has been extended. So, someone is in a processing cell now for 2 weeks, 20 days. And in that period, we've seen that people have had extremely limited access to their lawyers. In some cases, they were only allowed to call their lawyer if the phone was on speaker in front of one of the officers, so no privacy to communicate with their lawyer. We also saw that where people had ended up hospitalized, their family members and lawyers were not able to communicate them when they were hospitalized. And in one case, there was a woman who thought her husband had died because for weeks she wasn't able to contact him.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Belkis Vile of Human Rights Watch about its scathing new report on conditions at South Florida migrant detention centers. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I want to read here a response to the report from the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees ICE, the agency that runs migrant detention. Quote, "Any claim that there are subprime conditions at ICE detention centers are false," and false was written in large capital letters. Quote, "All detainees are provided with proper medical treatment and have opportunities to communicate with their family members and lawyers, ensuring the safety, security, and well-being of individuals in our custody as a top priority for ICE. ICE has higher detention standards than most U.S. prisons that hold actual U.S. citizens," unquote. Belkis, what is your and Human Rights Watch's reaction to that Homeland Security rebuke of your report? You point out, I know, that what's happening at these detention centers actually violates ICE's own standards, if not international human rights treaties.
Yeah, I mean that response to me is absolutely shocking. I mean, if you look at the data that is publicly available shows very clearly a facility like Crome ended up at three times its capacity. So already there, you have a problem where the facilities are not abiding by the rules set out for them. And obviously, if you have a place at three times its capacity, you are going to have impacts. At Crome, only five men per cell per day are allowed to make what's called a sick call to speak to a medical personnel. And so if you're 140 people in that cell now, that means even more limited access to medical care. I mean, those are the simple facts. The other thing I think is really important to point out is that we've seen this government basically dissolve some of the key institutions that were set up as oversight bodies to make sure that ICE is abiding by its standards, and that facilities holding immigrants are not committing violations of those standards, and those bodies don't exist anymore, right?
Right.
So the entire system to ensure compliance is now gone.
I was actually struck by the last line of that Homeland Security response, the point it made of emphasizing that they're supposedly treating migrants better than U.S. citizens, which brings us to the argument many conservatives are making, especially in President Trump's MAGA movement, that even if undocumented migrants don't have criminal histories per se, they're still criminals because they're in this country illegally, and therefore there's something wrong with expecting that they somehow receive better treatment in detention than, say, a U.S. citizen would. What's your response to that argument?
I think you're totally right in picking up on that, what I find, disturbing language because of its implications. And I think that is exactly why we're seeing the kind of treatment and conditions that we are now seeing with this, chronic denial of access to medical care, including for drugs that some people need that, yes, may be expensive, but an impression or a feeling amongst ICE, amongst officers and the companies running these prisons, that these particular detainees don't deserve the treatment that they have the right to. And therefore, that is what is leading to conditions worsening. That is what's leading to these degrading incidents with guards abusing detainees and doing so with complete impunity. It's that very attitude that I think is driving this really nasty treatment that immigrants are facing now in these
And
facilities.
we should point out, as your report points out, that in Crome, for example, the population there is mostly now non-criminal undocumented migrants, not criminal undocumented migrants, just to point that out. Now, Belkis, President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill that just passed gives ICE $45 billion more for migrant detention. Do you perhaps hope or even believe that ICE will use those new resources to improve the conditions your report condemns in these detention centers?
This new development, so much more money going to ICE, is of deep concern to us. And it's of concern to us because the abusive practices that we've documented here in Florida in these three facilities, we know is not unique to these facilities. These are concerns we have across all ICE detention centers that we have looked at for years now. And so this is throwing more money at bad, at an abusive system. And it was ICE itself that developed in 2004 an entire program on alternatives to detention for immigrants.
Right.
So why is it that the default right now for ICE is simply to throw people into detention and continue to expand a system that in and of itself is problematic when there
Right.
are alternatives and there are alternatives that
Right.
work?
So finally, let's discuss those alternatives. Your report, of course, makes recommendations to either scale back migrant detention, to stop making it mandatory, for example, or to at least make it more, as you call it, community-based. Is there any chance Congress will, in fact, address the problems your report brings up and pursue some of these alternatives, as you call them?
As you say, the political situation and predicting, what Congress might do in this regard, I think is hard to do. And of course, I mean, so much of this is tied up in this administration's agenda, and many Republicans not wanting to take up a position that is unpopular with this administration. I would say, though, there is one other key recommendation we make, something that's quite simple and something that really affects a lot of Republican Congress people in states that have large immigrant populations, and that is the decision by this administration to have terminated the TPS, CHNV, and humanitarian
Humanitarian
parole
parole, yeah.
programs, right? These are programs that brought people from Cuba, Haiti, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Afghanistan to the United States lawfully, and
Yeah.
these are people who have come to the United States, are members of communities, are hardworking, and suddenly, because their statuses have been terminated, these people now are going to be at risk of being detained and put into these very same facilities.
Yeah.
And the termination of these programs was done counter to their entire intended purpose.
Right.
These programs are only meant to be terminated if the situation in their home country changes for the better, and it has not.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, Belkis. Belkis Vile is Associate Director in the Crisis, Conflict, and Arms Division of Human Rights Watch. Belkis, many thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, DeSantis Doge goes after Broward County. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis seems singularly focused on making himself President Trump's policy sidekick. He's arguably the most zealous partner of the administration's sweeping drive to arrest and deport undocumented migrants. He's hunting down wokeness wherever it lurks. And he's created his own version of Elon Musk's Federal Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. His Florida Department of Government Efficiency is now auditing the spending of local governments statewide. And not surprisingly, say DeSantis's critics, one of Florida DOGE's biggest targets is the Democratic stronghold of Broward County. The governor is accusing Broward of, quote, burdening its residents with what he calls unwarranted spending sprees, and he's threatening the county with state sanctions for not supporting the DOGE effort. Broward officials insist their finances are, in fact, in line with budget norms, and at least one county commissioner is calling DeSantis's assertions a, quote, political stunt. Joining me now for the first part of our discussion about this is Broward County Mayor Beam Furr. Mayor Furr, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Hi, Tim. How you doing?
Great. And a little later, we will also talk with Broward County Commissioner Steve Geller. Are you a Broward County resident? What do you think of Florida DOGE's crackdown there and in other Democratic pockets like Gainesville? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mayor Furr, you and Broward County Administrator Monica Sapero received a letter from Governor DeSantis's new chief financial officer, Blazing Golia, saying that while Broward County has sent it the financial information the state requested, the county has yet to pass a resolution supporting Florida DOGE's campaign of auditing the state's local governments. Therefore, Broward is not in compliance and faces state penalties. Mayor, what do you make of this, and how does Broward County intend to respond?
Well, first of all, I think we have been fully compliant. Everything that they have asked for in terms of all kind of numbers, budgets, we have sent them everything. So, and we will. We have nothing to hide. We're happy to send whatever they ask for. And if they find something somewhere we can do better, you know, we'll do better.
Mm-hmm. I want to play a clip here from Governor DeSantis's press conference this week, which he held there in Fort Lauderdale, we should note, in which he sort of lays out his basic financial complaint about Broward County.
Over the last 5 years, taxpayers here in Broward have watched their county government has increased property tax burdens by the tune of $450 million in addition to ad valorem collections. So that's an increase of close to 50% just since 2020. But yet, the population of Broward has barely grown at all, less than 5% net since 2020. So why is the tax going up almost 50% while the population is going up less than 5%?
Mayor Furr, what's your response to the governor's assertion there that Broward is somehow taxing and spending more than its population realities warrant?
Well, if you actually heard earlier in that press conference, he said what should be the normal would be a combination of inflation and population growth.
Uh-huh.
Well, and when you look at Broward, if you combine those two, we have an effective rate of 33%. The actual rate, if you were combining inflation and population growth, would be 32%. We're right in line with what would be what he is saying is the expectations of government given the inflation challenges that all governments are facing.
And we should point out Wall Street gives Broward County a AAA rating in that regard in terms of finances and credit worthiness, no?
Yeah. I mean, there's only 1.5% of the counties in the United States that have a triple bond rating. Not only do we have a triple bond rating, we have no debt. We've increased our reserve, and we've attended to all kind of capital infrastructure during this time. We've had a transportation surtax that was added. That's more money coming in. In 2018, that was voted on by a whopping amount of people from Broward County because they wanted to alleviate congestion and enhance mobility.
Right.
That's a lot. They wanted that. They wanted us to spend that money to improve their quality of life.
Right. But is the governor right that there may be some areas of, say, overspending, spending sprees, as he put it, that Broward County government does acknowledge that maybe it needs to rein in a little bit?
You know what? I if there is, we'll wait to see on that. But the things that he asked to look at, let's say procurement is the first thing. Procurement, for people who don't know, that's when we're giving contracts to people.
Sure.
And most people don't realize in Broward County, we have taken the politics out of that. We're probably one of the only counties in the United States that has done that.
Mm-hmm.
No commissioner is on the selection committee. We get the professionals to do that. And so, you know what? I think we've done it, and we're a good example of how to handle procurement.
So as a Democrat, Mayor, do you feel this is less a case of actual fiscal oversight and more an exercise in political targeting, especially since other Democratic-governed local governments in Florida, like Gainesville, where almost two-thirds of voters opposed President Trump in the election last year, are also facing DOGE sanctions?
I think we'll have to wait to see what that trend line looks like. I mean, when it's just a point, you don't have a line.
Right.
So, you know, until you actually start to see a trend line that way, we'll wait and see. But right now, between us and Alachua,
okay. You're
starting to see the beginnings of a trend.
Yeah. But in the larger picture, Mayor, what's your sense of the actual need for a Florida version of DOGE? And what effect do you think this state auditing initiative will end up having on local governments in Florida and their budget autonomy? That is what local autonomy still exists on this peninsula.
Well, yeah, you know, when the feds did it, the first thing they did was examine their own federal programs. I thought when the state passed it, the state would at least first look at their own state programs, not start to look at, you know, at the local level.
Right.
To be honest, they should be starting there, because when you're looking at things that are close to home, and like climate change or when I say climate change, if you're in South Florida, we're facing it much sooner than anybody in northern or central Florida. So yeah, we're going to be paying attention to that.
Right.
If when they're looking at DEI, you know what? We're a minority majority county. We're going to be looking at things differently.
Yeah.
And all these kind of things, the local, from, you know, the closer you are to the people, the better it is
right. To
be making those decisions.
Not,
I don't think it's great where they're trying to make decisions for our county from afar.
Beam Furr is the mayor of Broward County. Mayor, thanks again for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I was just speaking with Broward County Mayor Beam Furr about being targeted by Governor DeSantis' state version of DOGE. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for it, the South Florida Roundup podcast, in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. I want to turn now to Democratic Broward County Commissioner Steve Geller to go into some of the more granular aspects of this growing rift between Florida DOGE and Broward. Commissioner Geller, thanks for coming on.
Happy to be here.
I want to go back to that clip of Governor DeSantis we played earlier, specifically his claim that Broward County's budget has been increasing by some $1.2 billion a year, while its population growth has been declining some 5%. I know you have problems with his math. What are they?
I do. Let me say two things. First of all, the actual numbers disagree. We have no idea where he came up with the $1.2 billion. I've got the actual numbers. They have gone up under $2 billion in the 5 years combined,
mm-hmm.
our total spending. That is not $1.2 billion a year. That comes up to about $400 million a year,
mm-hmm.
number one. Number two, as Mayor Furr accurately pointed out, if you look at, I know that, for example, CFO Ingolia said that you should look at the 5% population growth, and it should only go up by 5% our budget. Republicans, when they were just campaigning for president, their big issue was inflation. You cannot ignore inflation. As Mayor Furr said, if you look at our total spending went up by 33.9% over the 5 years, while population growth and inflation was 32.9%. There's a 1% difference over 5 years, 0.2%. So that's virtually no change. They match. Number three, and this is really important, you have to look at where our numbers go. According to a recent letter from the Attorney General to our sheriff, and we agree with the numbers, 55.7% of the county's general revenue budget goes directly to the Broward County Sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't fully control that money.
Okay.
If we don't give the sheriff what he asks or negotiate a number with him, they get to go to the governor and cabinet and ask the governor and cabinet to increase the amount that we give them. So we have been giving them a higher amount than the other county spending, which is okay with me. I think the most important duty of government is to protect its citizens. Had we not given the sheriff this large amount of money, they would have said, oh, they are defunding the police. The governor and cabinet would say they're defunding the police.
Right.
They don't support law enforcement. When we do give them that money, then they say that, we're spending too much, but our increase in spending is to the sheriff.
Now, we've been talking about spending, but there's also the issue of taxes. You've also refuted Governor DeSantis's claim that from 2021 to 2024, Broward County saw a tax increase in the area of $450 million. You claim it's more in the area of $340 million, no?
Yes, but that's exactly correct. One of the problems that the governor has in his letters and press is that they keep switching metrics. The numbers that they asked us for were for the 3 year period, and that's the 340. They never asked us on the 5 year period, and then he announces the numbers over a 5 year period.
Right.
I don't have those numbers, I just have the percentages.
Okay.
But there's one important thing I do want to point out. When the governor said that they were auditing us because we were non-compliant, that's really important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is they said, well, we didn't pass a resolution in favor of DOGE.
Yeah.
Well, candidly, I'm not in favor of it because we have our local government autonomy. But I want to be very clear on two items. Number one, he said around 75 state agencies, counties or cities passed resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
That's out of 500, meaning only give or take 15% passed resolutions in favor. 85% didn't. That doesn't mean we're not in compliance if we're one of the 85%.
But
will follow the law. Absolutely. We are not saying, no, you know, take a long walk on a short pier. We're not going to respond. We've given them everything they've asked for, and we will.
But will the Broward County Commission then pass this resolution supporting the Florida DOGE auditing effort, as other local governments like Hillsborough County and the city of Miami down here have done?
As I said, only around 15% have done that. I doubt that we are going to pass a resolution saying we support it when, candidly, I don't particularly support it, but I will follow the law. If that's the law, and it is, we will give them everything they ask for. We're not going to disobey the law. We'll give them what they want. They just can't make us say, and we like the fact that they've selected Broward County as the big Democratic county as their target. Remember, the governor since April has been saying we've been overspending before they had any of this.
And you recently called DOGE's pressure a, quote, political stunt because Governor DeSantis seems to be leaning on blue Florida, as it were, Democratic strongholds like Broward County and Gainesville, as we mentioned earlier. If that's the case, then finally here, Commissioner, in the 30 seconds we have left, do you think anything Broward does at this point to comply will satisfy Florida DOGE?
We have a budget all in of about $8 billion, including our airport and seaport, which is six of the eight. in a budget our size, they will find things that they disagree with, like we would if we audited Walmart or Costco or any notoriously frugal large company. Okay. I hope that they do not substitute their judgment for our judgment. If they find savings, great, we'll enact them.
Okay.
But please don't substitute their judgment for ours.
All right. Steve Geller is Commissioner for Broward County District 5. Commissioner, many thanks.
Anytime.
Still to come, our reporters talk about the centennials and the stories of South Florida's cities. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. This year, WLRN has been airing a fascinating historical series called History We Call Home, looking at the raft of city centennials being celebrated across South Florida. From Coral Gables to Boca Raton, these reports have reminded us how much of this subtropical region took shape back in the mid-1920s, when the great real estate boom of that decade spawned municipal charters up and down the coast. We've heard how Jupiter became America's maritime life-saving station pioneer, about the Bahamians who built the iconic Venetian Pool, the hotel that put Hollywood, Florida's Hollywood, on the map. So today we wanted to chat with three of those WLRN journalists about their recent centennial reports. Joining me now is our Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus, who will tell us about Boca Raton's important historic black neighborhood, Pearl City. Our Morning Edition producer, Amy Sanchez, is here to talk about the history of Miami's iconic downtown Freedom Tower. And Broward County reporter Carlton Gillespie will fill us in on Deerfield Beach's journey from Al Capone haunt to Broward Boomtown. How are you guys?
Good, Tim.
Good.
Hey,
good.
All
Thank
is well,
you.
Tim.
Great to hear it. Do you live in a South Florida city celebrating its centennial? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Wilkin Brutus, I want to start with you and your deep dive into one of South Florida's most interesting black communities, the Pearl City neighborhood of Boca Raton. When we talk about black migration a century ago, we usually think of south to north, from states like Georgia to cities like Chicago, for example. You point out that Boca Raton actually benefited from a north to south black migration from states like Georgia to Pearl City. Tell us how that played out and how important Pearl City became to the city Boca Raton eventually became.
Yes, it's certainly a story that isn't told often. The Pearl City neighborhood, which was established in 1915, about a decade before Boca Raton's incorporation, was built to house black farm workers who were quite essential to the booming farming industry in early Boca Raton. And so this was part of a wave of black, white, and even Japanese folks who migrated to the area in the late 19th and early 20th centuries for better pay in farming. Mm-hmm. And so Pearl City had its own black family-run businesses because it had to during the Jim Crow era.
Right. And Pearl City, though, I mean, I gather from your report very vividly that Pearl City, you know, wasn't just an important historic black community. It was an important community in terms of developing Boca Raton itself, no?
Oh, absolutely. So, some of the stories itself describes folks who had spent time in the military.
Right.
There was a military base. Black folks were very much involved in that. The community itself had juke joints and restaurants and grocery stores. Definitely part of the early development of Boca Raton. So you can't really describe the early parts of Boca Raton without Pearl City, primarily because of its early influences.
Now, of course, Pearl City's residents had to face the harsh realities of segregation. And I want to play a clip here of a woman you interviewed, Marie Hester, who remembers those days.
Like, you can't go to this place or that place. Blacks have to go through the back door. When you go to the grocery store, make sure just to drink out of the black water fountain. I was never told why either. Most of the pioneers did not tell you why. They just would say, you do what I tell you to do, and this could save your life.
Wilkin, just briefly, tell us about Pearl City today, a century after it overcame those Jim Crow days in South Florida.
I want to say Marie Hester's mom is 96 years old. So it was an absolute pleasure speaking with these women who are in their 70s and 80s. And so while some descendants like Marie Hester have returned and remodeled their ancestral homes, typical migration patterns, gradual integration and gentrification led many Black residents to move away. But the neighborhood's legacy lives on through its remaining two historic churches, many preserved homes, and community spirit, because, you know, Boca economy is now driven by finance, tech, and healthcare rather than farming. And so the neighborhood still has its community spirit because there's all sorts of events catering towards Pearl City.
No, it's great work, Wilson. Amy Sanchez, you gave us a compelling centennial history last week of the Freedom Tower in downtown Miami. Walk us briefly through what the Freedom Tower originally was and the inspiring Miami Statue of Liberty, as one source calls it, that it later became.
Yeah, so the Freedom Tower first opened in 1925, and it served as the headquarters for the newspaper, the Miami Daily News and Metropolis. But then that newspaper moved out three decades later, and essentially the tower was left without an owner and really without purpose. But then the federal government in 1962 turned the tower, or the building at that time, into a processing center.
And it became a processing center because of...
It became a processing center because of the hundreds of thousands of Cubans that were fleeing the communist revolution. And so at that processing center, they received financial aid and food, medical care. And they also found out about different job opportunities that they were also offering.
Now, you, of course, had some moving interviews with people, particularly Cubans escaping communism back in Cuba, about their transit through Freedom Tower to a new and more hopeful life in Miami and America. And one of them was Luis Serrano, who described to you how he just barely made it out back in 1967.
Cuba had a policy, and the communist government had a policy, that if a male was between the ages of 15 and 27, they could not leave the country because that was considered military age. And so if we had not left when we did, when I was 14 and a half years old, we would have had to stay in Cuba because they would not have allowed me to leave.
Amy, what was your sense then of what the Freedom Tower means to people in Miami like Luis Serrano?
Honestly, a lot from what I gathered from people that I spoke with, it's just that the Freedom Tower means exactly what the name says. It means freedom for them.
Yeah.
It was this opportunity to be able to come to a new place and build a life that they didn't see for themselves in Cuba. And so it also, it speaks a little bit about their bravery and their courage for coming to a new place. And that's something that Luis mentioned as well when I was speaking with him. He said that he loved the fact that they treated him so well when he came, because you don't know what can happen when you take the risk and you go to another country to start a new life. And so I think for people that I spoke with, it means hope and freedom and this chance at a better and new life.
Right. Miami Statue of Liberty. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN reporters Wilkin Brutus, Amy Sanchez, and Carlton Gillespie about WLRN's fascinating series, History We Call Home, about the bounty of Florida cities turning 100 right now. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Carlton Gillespie, I was, of course, taken by your history of Deerfield Beach, not least of which because it has an Al Capone connection. I want to play a clip here from your interview with Jeff Fisk, a member of the Deerfield Beach Historical Society, who sort of sums up why the iconic gangster Capone ditched Miami and came north to Broward.
He was getting harassed so much in Miami that as soon as he would cross into the city limits, if a police car saw his vehicle, they would pull him over. They would make up something. They would. So, you know, he was getting pretty hot down there. So he was looking for a place that no one would bother him.
And Carlton, you report that a lot of that also had to do with the role the Hillsborough River played in the rum-running days of Prohibition a century ago. Tell us more about that.
Right. The Hillsborough River was dredged out by the Army Corps of Engineers into, and it happened to a number of these kind of inland rivers down in South Florida, but it was dredged in a straight line almost all the way to the Okeechobee Canal. So it was easy to kind of float something down the river and transport it out. And Capone specifically, it's like a movie scene. They would... He had a fish packing house right on the mouth of the river, right where the Intracoastal is. They would put the booze in the in a false bottom, put the false bottom on top, cover it with dry ice, pack it with fish, and send it off either to the railroad in the center of town in Deerfield or up the river to ship it out. It was, you know, it was, there was a ton of rum running in the operation, in
so
the area.
Your fish would have mercury and cane alcohol.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, there was a famous restaurant in nearby, what's now nearby Lighthouse Point called Cap's Place that opened in 1928. And, Cap Knight, the owner, was a notorious law flouter and rum runner, and there would be just barrels, kind of, they'd mark barrels and float them up the river, and then you know, they get picked up and the cash would get dropped at a later date. I mean, it was prevalent in this part of the county. It was really a lot of fun to uncover.
But obviously Deerfield Beach has moved beyond that portrait of itself from Prohibition to the modern and developed Broward County showcase it is today. But do folks there still embrace that colorful history to some extent?
You know, there was in Capone's old fish packing house, it was replaced with a place called the Riverview Restaurant. And that restaurant had some of the old gambling paraphernalia that was left behind by Capone kind of up on the walls until it was shut down. But no, I think in general, they don't. I mean, I'm from Northern Broward and I knew none of this. In fact, this whole story got kicked off. I was driving a couple of friends down Hillsborough Boulevard, and I pointed out the Butler House and said, I'm way behind the eight ball in this story. I've got to do something. And they said, we got to call your friend County. And my friend County Price, turns out he's the great, great, great grandson of George Emery Butler, the town's first mayor. Right. I had no idea.
Right.
So that certainly made sourcing a lot easier. But I think people just kind of don't realize the history that's beneath their feet.
Right.
A lot of times. That's why I think the series is so great.
Which brings me to the last question I want to ask all three of you. How this WLRN History We Call Home series perhaps gave you guys, yourselves, a greater appreciation of the history that exists here in a region that frankly has a reputation for not having much history. Wilken?
Yeah, you know, WLRN listeners throughout the years have engaged with many of my profiles about ethnic enclaves, whether it's the Hungarians or Finnish or indigenous Guatemalans, in this case, Black Americans in Pearl City. And so these stories about human migration and community often get swept under our historical lens. And so History We Call Home helps to reintroduce those voices beyond the Florida man tropes.
Yeah, I mean, you Wilken, you also reported on Jupiter and how lighthouses, for example, you know, really helped make South Florida, you know, not just an outlier or backwater, but an urban center.
Absolutely. You can't talk about Palm Beach County's history without its lighthouse. And so it also reintroduces folks in South Florida about the various histories within South Florida itself.
Amy, what about you?
Absolutely. It makes me have a greater appreciation because I myself took pictures at the Freedom Tower when I was a little girl, and I didn't know the history that I was basically standing in front of. And so it was really cool to also find out about
that. Yeah, and tell us about your own personal family history.
I'm Brazilian, but my parents are Ecuadorian, and so I came here to the U.S. to live here when I was 9 years old. And so that's when I went and I took a picture at the Freedom Tower in front of Bayside. And it was really cool to be able to learn about the place that I now call home.
Right. Carlton.
Well, there are, I push back. I would say there are people that are dedicated in preserving this history. We heard from Jeff Fisk earlier for my story. I mean, there are people out there who want to leave these things intact and protected. And I want to echo something Timothy Butler said in my story. He said of his late grandfather, he always told me, you're going to want to ask us more questions because when I'm gone, there's going to be nobody else who remembers. So that's what I would encourage people to do in their communities and keep this history alive.
But let me ask you just real quickly then in 10 seconds here. Again, do Deerfield Beach people, maybe perhaps as a result of your report, suddenly see a history that they never knew before?
That's certainly the response I've gotten from people.
Uh-huh.
I mean, plenty of people have said, oh, I had no idea this was going on. I grew up on this street. I mean, it's been a great response.
Carlton Gillespie is our Broward County reporter. Wilken Brutus is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Amy Sanchez is our Morning Edition producer. Many thanks as always, guys.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, we want to pay tribute to three South Florida giants who died this past week. Don Sofer, who founded Aventura, Roy Black, one of the nation's premier defense lawyers, and G. Holmes Braddock, who chaired the Miami-Dade County School Board through its journey to desegregation. Sofer was a real estate mogul best known for creating Aventura Mall. He was in fact known as the godfather of Aventura, a city whose development he helped engineer from 800 acres of swampland in the 1960s. Don Sofer died Sunday. He was 92. Roy Black is perhaps perhaps best known for winning the 1991 acquittal of William Kennedy Smith on a rape charge in Palm Beach, the first trial of its kind to be televised nationally. At the time of his death, Black still continued to work at his law firm on Miami's Biscayne Boulevard. Roy Black died on Monday. He was 80. G. Holmes Braddock, as chair of then Dade County schools in the 1970s, championed the district's desegregation efforts. He also pushed for bilingual education and school volunteer programs. G. Holmes Braddock Senior High School in Kendall bears his name. G. Holmes Braddock died Wednesday, just a day after turning 100 years old. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.